This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 20th, 2001. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Muslim clerics ask Osama bin Laden to leave voluntarily and threaten a holy war if Afghanistan is attacked. A former Navy admiral for India says what's needed is a holistic approach to ending terrorism. And advocates of peace nationwide make their voices heard amid the clamor for a war on terrorism. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Aaron Glantz with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Students at more than 100 colleges around the country are holding peace rallies today in response to last week's attacks on the United States and the military buildup in the Persian Gulf and South Asia. One school in Greensboro, North Carolina, also mourned the increasing violence against people perceived to be responsible for the terrorism. Dave Lippman has more from North Carolina.
As troops are deployed from North Carolina bases, individual attacks on Arab Americans have made that community jittery. Rania Masri, National Board Member of Peace Action and an Arab American, has been tracking the assaults, including one at Guilford College in Greensboro.
They were trying to do an educational forum against racism to try to quell the tension in the university. That same day, unfortunately, a 19-year-old student from Lebanon was physically assaulted. He was beaten up, and they told him, quote, "Go home, terrorist."
Attacks have lessened since the initial spate of violence, but dangerous harassment continues.
Bomb threats have stopped. However, there have been some very, very dangerous, vicious rumors spread about Arab-owned stores in the sense that, oh, these Arabs were supporting the terrorist attack. The mood is very frightful. We are scared. We are scared for the erosion of our civil rights, and we are also scared for our lives and our own protection.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dave Lippman in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, President Bush will speak at a joint session of Congress. He is expected to detail the administration's military intentions. The World Bank and International Monetary Fund meetings scheduled for the last weekend in September may have been canceled, but as Thatcher Collins reports, the World Trade Organization still plans to meet in Qatar.
The WTO chose the remote kingdom of Qatar for its security in preventing a protest like the one that shut down the last WTO ministerial in Seattle. The European Union and United States have committed themselves to the meeting despite September 11's terrorist attack on the U.S. Unnamed trade officials report that the ministerial would be canceled if the U.S. trade ministers pull out for security reasons. Yesterday, the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, announced its plan to give Pakistan loans to prevent an economic crisis in a country that has offered its territory and airspace to the U.S. for the anti-terrorism war. Pakistan received a three-year, $90 million IMF loan in 1997. The G8 Organization of Major Industrial Nations ended that in May 1998 after Pakistan tested nuclear weapons. Pakistan has $3 billion in debt. Thatcher Collins, Free Speech Radio News.
Australia's Prime Minister John Howard has joined Britain's Tony Blair as the second world leader to offer military support to the U.S. Rachel Maher reports from Melbourne.
The Australian government has put defence forces on high alert, with troops and ships ready to depart upon the call to action from America. Australia, as a defence partner of the United States, has an intrinsic role in U.S. military activity, particularly in supplying intelligence information for US operations from the joint facility at Pine Gap in Central Australia. This facility features prominently in the US National Missile Defense Strategy and is an extremely high security surveillance operation, conveniently for the US government, located on the other side of the world. While Australia's entire military operation is a mere fraction of America's, the Australian government has always been keen to express and contribute their support for US military activity. Over the past 50 years, since becoming an ally of the US, Australia has sent troops to fight and die alongside American forces in the Gulf War, Vietnam, and Korea. In light of this, Australian peace, environment, union, and religious groups have continued to call for alternatives to military retaliation and have maintained peace vigils around the country. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rachel Maher in Melbourne, Australia.
And finally, the Pacifica Board met yesterday and named new board members to what critics say is an already democratically weakened radio network. Max Pringle reports.
The new board members are Marion Barry, former Washington mayor, civil rights activist Dick Gregory, marketing professional Krishna Roy, Houston area former ACLU board member George Barnstone, and James Ferguson, a former executive director of the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation. Dissident board members protested vigorously the seating of the new members, saying the majority members were attempting to stack the board. However, Majority Board Member Valerie Chambers of Houston said that it's time to move on.
I'm concerned about how we can bring the most good to Pacifica.
The board also agreed to convene an emergency meeting in 2 weeks to resolve the Democracy Now! Issue. KPFA in Berkeley is the only Pacifica-owned station airing new Democracy Now! Programs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in Berkeley.
And I'm Aaron Glantz for Free Speech Radio News.
In Afghanistan today, hundreds of Islamic clerics called on Osama bin Laden to leave the country voluntarily, but gave no indication they would support handing him over to the United States. The clerics had been convened by the military rulers of Afghanistan to weigh U.S. demands that bin Laden be turned over. The clerics said they were prepared to call for a holy war against the United States if U.S. troops attack Afghanistan in an attempt to capture bin Laden. President Bush is set to address Congress this evening, and aides say that while Bush may not announce a military strike is underway, he will ask Americans to have patience for a long, painful war against terrorism. Jeremy Scahill has more.
The decision today by the Shura, or Religious Council in Afghanistan, is a bit of a curveball. While the council did not concede to Washington's demands to hand over Osama bin Laden, it did issue a recommendation to the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan to persuade bin Laden to leave the country voluntarily. The statement released by hundreds of Afghan clerics went on to warn that when a powerful country like the United States attacks a weak country, it's a jihad or holy war for all Muslims. Suhail Shaheen is a spokesperson for the Taliban in Islamabad. He told reporters today there is no reason that bin Laden should be handed over to the U.S. and that there's nothing to indicate he has violated any laws.
If he has violated that commitment, we are telling Americans, please prove that he has violated that commitment, but they are not proving.
The White House today rejected the decision by the Afghan clerics, repeating its demand that Osama bin Laden be handed over immediately. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has begun moving large numbers of warships and attack planes to the region. President George W. Bush will address both houses of Congress tonight. His advisors say it will not be a speech to announce military action. And in startling remarks at the Pentagon today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld outlined one of the goals of Bush's new war on terrorism.
What is victory? I say that victory is persuading the American people and the rest of the world that this is not a quick matter that's going to be over in a month or a year or even 5 years. It is something that we need to do so that we can continue to live in a world with powerful weapons and with people who are willing to use those powerful weapons. And we can do that as a country. And that will be a victory in my view.
President Bush's address to Congress tonight is not likely to contain any specific military plans, but the Congress seems poised to follow whatever his administration decides. The House vote to authorize the use of military force yielded only one dissenting vote. The Senate vote was 98-0. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jeremy Scahill.
Members of the United Nations Security Council agreed last night that any global fight against terrorism should be led by the United Nations and not the United States. But as Susan Wood reports from the UN, the Bush administration has made it clear it will not wait for a UN resolution.
The Financial Times of London reports Britain and France are pressing the UN Security Council to adopt resolutions urging countries to turn over suspected terrorists, freeze their assets, and share information. Since 1999, the UN has imposed economic sanctions on the Taliban, which it doesn't recognize as the government of Afghanistan. The Financial Times says diplomats are now discussing ways of strengthening those sanctions, including penalties for countries that refuse to cooperate with the measures already in place. However, it's unlikely the Council would approve a total trade embargo on Afghanistan, similar to the one imposed on Iraq following the Gulf War. Many of its 15 members feel the Iraqi sanctions regime has had a devastating impact on the civilian population. After meeting with President Bush in Washington, French President Jacques Chirac held a joint news conference at the United Nations yesterday with Secretary General Kofi Annan. Chirac urged the United Nations to lead the fight against terrorism, saying it must go beyond military action to target the root causes. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said yesterday the U.S. would not seek U.N. approval for military action. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Pakistan President General Musharraf's statement yesterday on national television didn't play well in New Delhi, India. Musharraf had billed his speech as an explanation to the people of Pakistan for his decision to back the U.S. in its hunt for Muslim terrorist Osama bin Laden. In his address to Pakistan, Musharraf portrayed his decision as being spurred by patriotism and rooted in Islamic principles. He stressed repeatedly the need to make decisions based on wisdom rather than emotion. He recalled how the Prophet Muhammad had once made an apparent concession that in the long run proved to be a wise choice. But the Muslim leader also weaved the age-old dispute between Pakistan and India into his comments, saying India had given him no choice but to side with the U.S. Musharraf accused India of trying to exploit the crisis by offering its full support to the U.S. in any retaliatory strikes on Afghanistan. India wants to isolate us, move closer to the U.S., and get us declared a terrorist state. They have offered all their military facilities, all their bases, and full support, he said. India's foreign minister responded by saying, instead of focusing on terrorism, which is responsible for the present situation, it is most regrettable that the president of Pakistan continues to give voice to an anti-India tirade. Admiral Ramu Ramdas is the former chief of the Indian Navy, turned peace activist. He told Free Speech Radio News he condemns terrorism in any form, but he believes the world needs to take a more holistic approach to ridding the world of such violence.
You see, India has always condemned terrorism, and this is nothing new. But India doesn't automatically say that how to deal with it, or perhaps this is the way to deal with it, or that's the way to deal with it. I think one has to have a holistic strategy for this. It's not just military strategy alone, and it's just, you know, knocking out somebody that is going to solve the problem. It won't. Something much more fundamental. It's got to do with socioeconomic situations. It's also got to do with benign neglect of hundreds and thousands of people worldwide who've been suffering. And nobody bothers. Nobody seems to care. And others get away with murder, literally. And no, the world keeps quiet under those circumstances. So I think now we have to do a certain amount of serious heart searching and say, what is it? Why is it? And how do we combat this? Undoubtedly, any form of terrorism is always reprehensible and must be condemned. But just eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth is not the answer.
Well, now, Admiral, yes, Admiral, when you speak of people suffering and others getting away with it, can you speak in more specific terms?
Well, let's look at Palestine. Let us look at the refugees in Palestine. For the last 50 years, there are millions of people in refugee camps rotting away. Two generations have been born in refugee camps. What have we done about them? I'm not for a moment suggesting that this is the actions in New York or elsewhere is therefore pardonable or understandable. No. But certainly we have to look at these things in much more deeper perspective. And I think we are only providing the conditions for young people to be misled readily by various people who claim to be, you know, doing whatever they are doing. And therefore, I think it's terribly important that instead of knee-jerk reactions to these kind of situations, we need to look at this much more, as I said, in depth and evolve a consensus, strategic approach on all fronts and alleviate the causes which cause these kind of reactions and responses. And I think it's terribly important that we do that. And I think violence and counter-violence continues to breed more violence. I think we have to learn lessons from Gandhi. There is no alternative to that, or to learn lessons from Martin Luther King.
What might be a more peaceful approach to solving this problem with terrorism that is before the world at this particular time?
I think the present levels of injustices, you know, we talk about democracy on a nationwide basis, but there seems to be no democracy or democratic space on an international level. I think people need to demonstrate genuineness by giving every country and peoples worldwide a space to express their democratic rights. And therefore, I think we have to become much more concerned and sensitive to people's issues. Human lives are the same all over the world. And we need to therefore look at it along those lines, along humanitarian lines. And any problems we look at must have a human face. And human faces are the same, irrespective of the color or the background that they come from.
How does someone who was an admiral for the Navy of India arrive at such a strong position of peace advocacy?
The reason is very simple. I've been through wars and I've found it has not solved any problems. And it never will. And I think one is a professional's viewpoint on how to go about a job which duty demands. But then it doesn't mean you're a individual who does not think. You have to think. Colin Powell is Secretary of State for the United States, and he's a former general, Chairman Chiefs of Staff. So you have to have a holistic view of all these things.
Admiral Ramu Ramdas, former chief of the Indian Navy and peace activist. He is also a member of the Indian-Pakistan Friendship Association and the India-Pakistan Soldiers Association. At the University of California, Berkeley students moved to occupy the offices of their student newspaper, the Daily Californian. The 130 most Arab American students who took part in the protests are upset about a political cartoon the paper ran depicting two men wearing Middle Eastern attire in hell. Mitch Jesherich reports from Berkeley.
Really, Cal, you must know, racist speech has got to go.
Since the bombings on Tuesday, have European Americans been racialized as terrorists?
There were no European Americans who were terrorists in the bombings on Tuesday.
How do you know that?
We have to stand forward and say we're not going to tolerate stereotyping.
So tell me this, does that cartoon look like a Sikh American or a Muslim American?
I actually have no idea.
Exactly.
That's why I don't commit any crimes.
Would you not have understood?
It doesn't matter. That's racist.
Those were the sounds at UC Berkeley's Sproul Plaza. Students gave speeches and debated whether an editorial cartoon published in the campus's paper, The Daily California, is offensive to people from Central and Western Asia. The cartoon, drawn by syndicated cartoonist Darren Bell, who works for the LA Times, shows two men with long beards dressed in robes and turbans. They are standing in hell. One man says, quote, "We made it to paradise. Now we will meet Allah and be fed grapes and be serviced by 70 virgin women." The other man stands next to him with a flight manual book. Huma Motami, a senior at UC Berkeley, explained, as a Muslim, why the cartoon is offensive to her.
It seemed like it wasn't even from this time period. Like something like a character drawing. It reminded me of like the Japanese drawings that I used to see like after Pearl Harbor. That's the immediate depiction I get. Characters is like conditioning people to think of a group of people in a dehumanizing way so that, you know, it'll be justified when hate crimes happen to them.
The students are demanding an apology from the Daily Cal written on the front page. But the senior editorial board of the paper, in a written response, said that the paper will not issue an apology. The statement also said the cartoon solely represents the perspective of Darren Bell, the cartoonist. Jani Hugh, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Cal, says the cartoon does not reflect the opinion of the paper, but the editorial section is open to everyone.
It was an editorial cartoon. It was not it was in no way representative of the views of myself or the senior editorial board. Our opinion page exists as an open forum for community members to voice their opinions. A political cartoon is meant to exaggerate, be satirical, usually, you know, spark a debate.
Last night, a crowd of students occupied the Daily Cal office until the Berkeley police arrested 19 demonstrators who were later released. Rena Shah, president of the campus group Indus, says the Daily Cal should take responsibility for how it handles controversial images.
I really think that it was not an appropriate comment, especially considering the timing of the bombings of last week and all the hate crimes that are just increasing exponentially each day. I feel like it's their responsibility as responsible journalists to also report the truth and not necessarily distort that. If they had printed the cartoon with some sort of disclaimer at the bottom saying this cartoon was printed for the sole purpose of creating a discourse for people to discuss how ignorant things like this are, then I would have had no problem with it.
The Daily Cal editor, Jani Hugh, says the paper stands behind running the cartoon based on the principles of free speech.
In my opinion, I don't believe that the cartoon condoned any sort of hatred or racism. It was the singular expression of someone's commentary, and it can be interpreted in so many different ways, and in a lot of cases that's what political cartoons do.
Jenny Hugh also says those who did not like the cartoon can write letters to the editor and opinion pieces. She did say that the paper will look more closely at future pieces that may be considered offensive to racial groups. For Free Speech News, I'm Mitch Jezerich.
The avalanche of U.S. airline job cuts has more than doubled to 70,000 as carriers. The latest round of cuts came yesterday when the parent companies of American and United each announced layoffs of 20,000. A day earlier, Boeing said it planned to trim more than 30,000 in its commercial airlines division. Martha Baskin has more from Seattle.
It was a mix of emotions that hit the workers when Boeing made the announcement. Initially, they were skeptical that it was necessary to lay off between 20 and 30% of the workforce, or 30,000 employees. Then came deja vu. They'd been through it before. In 1971, after cancellation of the supersonic transport and other federal projects, 37,000 layoffs took place. In 1990, 5,000 jobs were cut, partly as a result of military budget cuts. From 1992 through 1995, between 6,500 and 5,000 jobs were cut annually, with Boeing citing cutbacks in the B-2 bomber and 737 production. By the year 2000, company-wide payroll was reduced from 238,000 jobs to 191,000. As seasoned workers knew, the airline industry was cyclical.
Anybody can see what happened to our customers this week.
Boeing spokesperson Tom Ryan.
The writing's on the wall. We had airplanes leaving out of LaGuardia, I think, that had four or five people on airplanes. You can't turn profit that way. And the airlines are bleeding right now, and so subsequently we're going to feel that. They're our customers.
But the sentiment that gave management the benefit of the doubt was the same one pervading the rest of the country, which isn't to say that the workers don't have a different take on what should be done or that they aren't concerned for their own jobs. It's that the antagonism evident in recent strikes has been muted by circumstance. The bulk of the layoffs will take place in the commercial division. The unit employs 93,700 workers nationally and 80,000 in Washington. Boeing's shared services group, which handles payroll, security, and other company-wide operations, will also cut some of its 15,000 workers. The International Association of Machinists hopes pending legislation to assist U.S. airlines will help mitigate the losses at Boeing. Bill Dugovich, spokesperson for Boeing's second-largest union, the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace.
Well, one of the things that came out of the meeting with the senator and the governor today was it's our assertion that if there is a bailout for the airlines, the workers at the Boeing factories who face layoffs need to be given at least the same consideration. This is just not a tragedy for the airline companies and for the Boeing company. This is a tragedy for the workers who will be laid off and lose their jobs.
Veteran machinist David Clay, who has run for president of the union on a reform slate, believes Boeing and the country could pursue other options.
If the company was really interested in engaging with the rest of the country in this newfound patriotism, I think that the country would save these jobs here, or at least mitigate it by bringing home all the work that it's outsourced to foreign nations.
By some estimates, close to 45% of Boeing's planes are already manufactured through outsourcing and technology transfer to Russia, Romania, Japan, South Korea, Italy, Australia, and China. Clay contends that it doesn't make sense to lay off skilled aerospace workers when the country appears to be on a war footing, and that Boeing, once again, is pursuing short-term gains at the expense of its workers, community, and national security. While the number of workers slated to lose their jobs in the airline industry is highest at Boeing, United Airlines has announced that it will lay off 20,000 workers. U.S. Airways has announced 11,000 layoffs, and Continental, 12,000. Continental executives predict that the industry could lose 100,000 jobs before the current round of layoffs is over. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin in Seattle.
Students across the country are assembling for messages of peace. Vigils and peace protests were scheduled for today at more than 50 colleges and universities. Chuck Rosina reports from Boston, where demonstrations are being held at Harvard, Brandeis, Boston College, Boston University, and the Berklee College of Music.
We are over. I ain't gonna
About 1,000 people held a candlelight peace vigil in Copley Square, Boston last night to express grievance and sorrow for the innocent victims in last week's attacks and to protest the pending loss of more innocent lives should the U.S. retaliate with a military strike. Carrying signs which read, "No more innocent victims, vengeance isn't justice, and don't turn tragedy into war," these people seemed determined to stand against a continued cycle of violence. One of the participants, Michael, wore a Veterans for Peace jacket. He fought in the Vietnam War.
I'm here because I think first world countries don't bomb third world countries, and that's what it looks like we're going to start doing, for one. That's what makes me sad. Everywhere I look, I see this patriotism that I think is going to turn into a bombing contest, and the people who are going to get bombed are third world people who had nothing to do with this. They're already without basic human rights and basic human needs, and it's only going to get worse.
How do you feel you can convince your fellow Americans to steer the course away from war?
I don't know if I can. First step is to come out here. First step is to make sure that I'm out here and I'm trying to do something.
The two doomed planes that struck the World Trade Center came from Boston, so there's much personal connection to the tragedy. Mark Greenfield shared his grief with those assembled.
You have to excuse me if I break down and cry right now, because this tragedy has hit me really hard. A very close friend of my dad's, my dad's best friend from when they were roommates in college, was on the plane. And all I can think about is the image of that plane hitting the tower and what the people on that plane must have been thinking. And since this has happened, this has been the longest week of my life, the most painful. And I guess what I want to say is that a lot of people are suffering right now, including myself. And despite that, I want to see the response to this tragedy be rational, compassionate, and peaceful. I'm really worried about where we're heading with this.
Mark Greenfield of Boston. Not everyone gathered shared in the nonviolent philosophy. About 12 young people stood on the outskirts of the crowd singing the Star Spangled Banner.
Well, honestly, I myself just think it's like this century's version of hippies. I mean, not the whole drug acid craze, but like, you know, all I see is a bunch of people getting together and just saying, "Peace, man, let's do nothing." And I don't think that's exactly right.
War isn't the option, it's the only option.
People's anger is understandable. We all feel it. I think everybody here feels angry, too. It's just that we have to make choices about how we respond, and I think violence begets violence.
Beth, a woman from Bedford, Mass., was among the majority gathered here. She hoped for a nonviolent solution.
Well, I don't know that I have a solution, and I can't guarantee that everybody will have this sentiment, but I think it's important to put it out there and hope that we can work for nonviolent solutions, because, I mean, it's such a tragedy, and to see more people die, innocent people dies, it's just very sad.
Amazing Grace. Minister and topical singer Fred Small ended the vigil by leading the crowd in a rendition of Amazing Grace. The group then quietly dispersed, with a large faction marching up to Harvard Square. Many are apprehensive about the days ahead. They fear that a military response will not make us more secure, but rather more vulnerable to continued violence. This afternoon, in conjunction with a nationwide student day of action, Harvard, MIT, Boston College, and Boston University all held their own anti-war rallies. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Chuck Rosina in Boston.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.